Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Helpful Key Themes of Best Business Books. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Jack Covert and Todd Satterston are arguably two of the most prolific booksellers, reviewers, bloggers, and purveyors of taste and popular opinion about business books that one can find anywhere. Jack is the founder of and chief mentor for 800 CEO Read, a subsidiary of the Harry W. Schwartz Bookshops in Milwaukee. He was hired 25 years ago by the late David Schwartz to promote business and computer books to the Milwaukee business community. Jack used his considerable sales skills and innate business acumen to grow the three-shelf business section into a $7 million specialty business book retailer. Regrettably, Jack could not be with us tonight. Todd is 800 CEO Read's president, having joined the company in 2004. Previously, he spent 6 years at GE and 3 years working with his father in the family sheet metal fabrication business. Todd received his BS in mechanical engineering from Michigan Technological University and his MBA from Marquette University. Like Jack, Todd also has a love of the big idea, and he saw endless potential in the future of 800 CEO Read. When he joined the company, he talked Jack into documenting all that he had learned from reading thousands of business books over the previous 25 years. Todd started a weblog in 2003 called A Penny For... one of the first business blogs on the internet. This led him to self-publish a compilation of essays from online writers called More Space. At 800 CEO Read, he writes web content, blog posts, and book reviews. Convinced that there are good business books if you know where to find them, he was inspired to team up with Jack to direct interested and curious readers to the best of the best. Please join me in welcoming Todd Satterston.
So let's start with two problems. Problem number one. When Gallup went out and asked employees whether or not they were engaged in their jobs, only 1 in 11 answered with an affirmative. Only 9% of employees say that they're actually engaged in the jobs that they're in. Problem number two. Chris Zook, who's a partner at Bain & Company, has said that 6 in 10 businesses are going to have to redefine their business model in the next 10 years. 6 in 10 to me seems like a small number considering the situation that we're in today. Now, if I had a whiteboard or a flip chart up here, I'm sure we could probably keep listing the problems that we're facing in the workplace. And it ranges from big things like I just described to small things like I get way too much email, my manager won't listen to me. We could go on and on and on. There probably wouldn't be enough paper for that. I think all of us as business people constantly deal with this idea of problems, and we're always trying to come up with solutions. We're constantly in that search for solutions. And where do we go? We go to all sorts of places. We read the media. We go to magazines. We go to newspapers. We take classes. We go get our MBA. We come to the Commonwealth Club. We ask friends. Right? We share our problems with our friends and say, have you had this experience before? Can you give me some recommendation on what I should do? And what I want to suggest tonight is that there might be another place to go. And maybe you've done this before, but I think you should reconsider it. And I'm hoping I'm going to make a really good case for that tonight. And the case, of course, I'm going to make is I think people should read more business books. Right, I think that they are an absolutely wonderful resource. When you consider the fact that they sit at this wonderful crossroads between I know nothing and gosh, let's go hire a consultant. When you think about the fact for the $20 that you're going to spend and the 2 hours that you're probably going to spend reading it, there's a pretty high value proposition there, okay? And that's really the thing. Business books provide solutions to problems. They're self-help, you know, and I mean that really in the greatest sense of the word, self-help. I'm not talking about, you know, the things that you kind of find in the, I'm not talking about Dr. Laura or Dr. Phil. What I'm really talking about is Emerson and Thoreau. That the idea that I think you can read business books and I think they can change people's lives. I don't think it's anything less than that. And what we found was that in this idea of us writing this book, it's called The 100 Best Business Books of All Time, but we think we could probably retitle it and call it The 100 Best Solutions of All Time, because that's really what it is. What we're trying to provide for the reader is this resource to give people directions to go, places to go check out that can provide solutions to a wide variety of problems. But one of the things we found after we finished writing the book was the fact that these 100 solutions were varied and they provided all sorts of different ways to go at problems. What we ended up finding, though, was the fact that oftentimes those problems that the solutions were remedies for were the same problems over and over and over again. And that's really what I want to talk about tonight. I think there's five big ideas, I should say five big themes, five big problems that I think people deal with in business constantly. Sense of purpose, wisdom in decision making, a bias for action, an openness to change, and mechanisms for feedback. And what I want to do tonight is I want to talk about each one of those, because what happens is that when people come and talk to me about books and they tell me, gosh, I just got done reading Good to Great, and it was such a great book, I got all these really good ideas. To me, what I think is actually going on is they're saying that they found a lot of great solutions, but I think what really good business books do is they also help you figure out what the problem is. That suddenly this thing that you know that something's going wrong, that there's all these things going on and you can't quite define what it is. I think a good business book helps you define that problem. And as I was just saying, I think those problems are recurring. And I think if we spent more time concentrating on a smaller set of problems, we would make more progress forward. So let me talk about the first one. And I want to talk about this woman, Jean. And Jean has a job that I think many people wouldn't all be all that interested in having. It's data entry. You know, so she's taking things from pieces of paper and punching them into computers, just numbers, all day long. Jean loves it, though. That's the thing. The average rate at which a data entry person can enter numbers is 380,000 key punches a month, which just seems enormous to me. But Jean can almost do this at almost twice the rate. She can do this at almost 560 key punches a month. And her managers noticed this, and they said, you know, what is it, I mean, what is it that you so enjoy about punching numbers into the computer? And she said, I love numbers. It's competitive. It's a game to me. I mean, I really find it very enjoyable. And so they sat down with her and said, do you think you could do better? I mean, do you think you could, I mean, if you're really into this data entry thing, do you think you could do better? And she said, yes, I think I could. So they sat down, came up with some goals. 2 months later, she was key punching at 1 million key punches a month. I mean, that's a twofold increase. 6 months later, she's key punching at 2 million. Her best month on record now is 3.5 million key punches in a month. A tenfold increase over anyone else, over the industry average. Tenfold. I mean, there has to be something different going on. And what I'm doing is I'm retelling a story from a book called First Break All the Rules by Marcus Buckingham and Kirk Kaufman, if you've read First Break All the Rules. And the case that they're making is that when you play to a person's strengths, they work better in the marketplace. So what actually ended up happening in the case of Jean is the managers at that company created a talent model for what this person looked like and how this person thought. And the average in that department now is 1 million key punches a month. So now, not only did they find someone who's really good at it, they've actually modeled their whole department around that person. And they've you know, they're three times better than the industry average. So in that case, it's really a sense of personal purpose, right? It's finding what it is that you're very good at and excelling in that, and finding occupations and pursuits that can help you pursue that. The personal story for us is there's a book called Strengths Finder, and it is sort of the latest incarnation of the Strengths movement from the Gallup organization. And it's a very simple book. It's probably about 30 pages, and then the rest of it sort of tells you about each one of the strengths. And the reason everyone buys the book is because it has this wonderful online tool to help you assess what your strengths are. And we did it at 800 CR Reed. We've got 15 employees. And what we've always thought our purpose, if we're going to tie this back into now organizational purpose, what we've always believed is our purpose is to help people. And that might sound very, you know, grand, but we believe whether it's helping people find what books they should read, or whether it's helping authors allow their books to become more successful, or organizations get through change efforts, being helpful is sort of at our core. And after we had everybody take the test, we compiled all the results. And what we found was that 11 of our 15 employees had empathy as one of their strengths. Now, I can tell you, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, we do not hire for empathy. That is not something we've been going out and doing. But clearly, it was something unconscious that both Jack and I have been thinking about over the years in terms of the people that we bring in, and certainly in terms of the people that we retain. Because people who do not thrive in an organization where they constantly have to be in a customer service function, in a way that they constantly have to be helping other people, if that doesn't fit someone's personal purpose, they generally move on to some other job. And so for us, this idea around strengths has been something that's been very important, and this idea of purpose. And what I want to do is I want to go back to that 1 in 11 number that I talked about just a second ago. And this is some follow-up research from Gallup. And what they said is, our studies indicate that people who do have the opportunity to focus on their strengths every day are 6 times as likely to be engaged in their job, and more than 3 times as likely to report having an excellent quality of life in general. I think that's pretty powerful stuff. You know, that if we, you know, we talk about this constant quest for trying to find purpose in our lives, and what we find is that we're happier in our jobs and that our general quality of life is better when we spend time figuring that out. That's one of those big sort of ideas that I want you, the first idea that I want you to take away with tonight. The next one I want you to think about is, and I'm going to ask somebody to help me here. What we're doing is we're going to the original management guru, Dr. Seuss. We'll be reading from Oh, the Places You Go. And if you'll just, second if you would, and if you would just read these 2 sections, it would be absolutely wonderful.
Glasses are not clean. You will come to a place where the streets are not marked. Some windows are lighted, but mostly they're dark. A place you could sprain both your elbow and chin. Do you dare to stay out? Do you dare to go in? How much can you lose? How much can you win? Do you want me to go in?
I would love for you just one more stand.
And if you go in, should you turn left or right, or right and 3/4, or maybe not quite, or go around back and sneak in from behind? Simple it's not. I'm afraid you will, for a mind maker upper to make up your mind, or make up his mind. Excuse me.
Simple it's not. I'm afraid you will find, for a mind maker upper to make up his mind. Right? I mean, and that's for you. Thank you for reading for us. So, for a mind maker upper to make up his mind. I mean, what are we talking about? We're talking about decision making here. You know, there are so many different kinds of decision making, and I only have enough time to really concentrate on one of them tonight. And I want to talk about intuition. Many of you, I'm sure, are aware of the book by Malcolm Gladwell, Blink. Yes, all sorts of people. I'm sure this audience would be very aware. I mean, Malcolm brought the idea of intuition to the forefront. What I want to talk about is I want to talk about one of the lesser characters, actually, in Blink. It was a guy named Gary Klein. And what he does is he's a researcher based out of Ohio who studies intuition. And if you're familiar with Gary Klein's story, he's been in Fast Company. Gary thought it'd be really interesting to try to figure out how people use their intuitive decision-making. And we use it every day. I mean, what are we going to wear to work today? And where are we going to go to lunch? I mean, those decisions happen in a heartbeat. And he wanted to try to slow down that process to see really what was going on in people's minds as they were going through that intuitive process. And he said, well, asking people, you know, how they decided what they were going to wear to work today probably wasn't going to be the way that they're going to get there. So what he did is he followed around people whose jobs were to save people's lives. He followed around firefighters. He followed around Marine Lance corporals. He followed around neonatal nurses in NICUs, or neonatal intensive care units. And what he found was that the process that we use for most decisions, you know, the deliberate ones, like where am I going to live and what car am I going to buy, and oftentimes what job am I going to get, am I going to take, it's very compare and contrast, right? We sort of write down option A and B and C and D, and we write down all the factors of them and what's the cost and benefit, and we kind of weigh all of them, one versus the other. What Gary found is that that's not at all how our intuitive mind works. So Gary would follow these firefighters to on calls. And fire captain takes his company into a house fire. And the captain is almost immediately bothered from the minute that he goes in the door. And there's something not right about the situation that he's been involved in. There's no smoke. I mean, from the outside, everything looked normal. But once he got inside, there was no smoke in any of the rooms. He wasn't sensing heat from anywhere. And he was in the building for about 60 seconds before he realized, I can't find something to explain this. And he pulled the whole company out, and the floor collapsed in the room that they were standing in. It turns out that the fire was actually had been burning in the basement. And that's the reason there was no smoke. That was the reason you couldn't sense any heat. And Gary gets back to the firehouse with the captain and sits down with him and said, so, you know, what happened? How did you come to this conclusion that you had to get your whole company out of there? And the guy goes, I don't know. I think it was ESP. I mean, I have no idea what was going on. And he said, well, let's slow it down. Explain to me what was going through your mind. And he walked back through all those things I just described. There was no smoke, there was no fire. And what Gary's figured out is the fact that the process of intuition is not that we see multiple options, not that our brain sees multiple options, but what our brain does is it takes in the input, and it gives you one solution. It gives you the one that is closest to the patterns, right? We always talk about how our brains are basically just pattern recognizers. And Gary's research absolutely confirms this, that he could not find a pattern that matched the one he was seeing. He'd been a firefighter for 25 years. We've been in tons of fires. And the minute after that minute that he could not come up with a solution, he got everybody out and left. So what Gary talks about is the fact that we can improve our intuition. It's not like intelligence, you know, where we're sort of, it's not one of those things we're born with. We can improve our intuition, and it's experience. I mean, that's the main way that we do it. Again, probably not a hugely eye-opening revelation in that the more experience that we have in a given situation, the more successful we are. But understanding that our brain makes those decisions and that it's not this, you know, one thing versus another thing versus another thing, but that we're sort of making this decision based on one thing what our brain keeps doing is just, it shows us that solution till it can find one that better fits the situation. So intuition is very important. 90% of the decisions that we make in a given day are intuition-based. So it's something that we should think about in terms of maybe improving our decision-making. The third thing I want to talk about is there's a book that came out in 1982 called In Search of Excellence. And it was Tom Peters and Bob Waterman. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's still a great book. If you haven't read it, it's worth going back and reading. The first thing out of the eight things that Peters and Waterman identified as being very important were the organizations that they saw that were successful in the 80s were ones that had a bias for action, right? And this seems, I mean, this seems very intuitive again. I mean, but how often is it that we get, you know, paralyzed by analysis, you know, paralyzed by you know, hemming and hawing about what's going to be the best way to get us where we need to. And the there's a wonderful book, and some of you may be familiar with it, called Getting Things Done by David Allen. And David Allen is sort of the, he's sort of come on in the last 10 years or so as the productivity guru. If you, many of you are, I'm sure, familiar with Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Covey sort of tends to take the very Western view of time management and purpose, and that, you know, what we want to do is we want to find our purpose, we want to use empathetic listening, we want to sharpen the saw. David Allen has a very Eastern view, almost a Zen view of time management. And what he believes is that what we must do is we must empty our mind of everything that it is that we need to deal with. And his philosophy is simply using to-do lists. Again, it sounds like the most basic, most simple thing in the world, that we should just going back to using the to-do list that, you know, when we're making groceries or whatever the case may be. But Allen makes a very important point. What he says is that people think they can manage time, they think they can manage information, and they think they can manage priorities. And you can't manage really any of those things. Can you manage time? Can you say, time, I would like some more, or I'd like to get something different? That's not how it works. Time just passes. Priorities, are we really able to manage our priorities? I mean, think how quickly, you know, in this sort of instant connection society that we're in, that email shows up, and whether it's the boss needs the report tonight or my son is sick at school, how fast your priorities change. You really can't manage your priorities. Information's no different, right? I mean, look at all the different ways that we can get information now. And what Allen says is the only thing we can do is we can only manage action, right? We can only manage, and what he says is to-do lists literally are, what is the next step that I need to take to get myself closer to where I'm going? And what he talks about is, I'll just read a quick section here. What you do with your time, what you do with information, and what you do with your body and your focus relative to priorities are those are the real options to which you must allocate your limited resources. The real issue is how to make the appropriate choices about what to do at any point in time. The real issue is how we manage actions. I think that's a pretty big, I mean, it shows up over and over and over again in management literature in one way or another, whether it's whether it is personally, whether we can personally act and personally make progress. Books like Execution, which was immensely popular, in 2003. You look at a book like Knowing Doing Gap, where Pfeiffer and Sutton talk about all these things that stop organizations from taking action. Again, how is it that we can figure out how to take personal action and make that be something that we focus on? And then also, how is it that organizationally we can build our organizations that they can be action-focused? The fourth theme is change. And I don't, you know, as I stand here speaking tonight, you know, change is a topic that, you know, I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on. I mean, the times that we are in, if they are encouraging change beyond anything I think we've seen, certainly in my lifetime. And absolutely. And what we need to have is we need to have an openness to change. And what we don't realize is we think it takes events like these, where the stock market is going to decline by 50%, that those are the times when, you know, we're going to embrace change and that change is going to be something different. Change is something that's happening every day, whether we want to accept it or not. And the part that I want to focus on tonight is change normally means what is it that's going to happen in the future? I mean, that's really what we're worried about, right? What is it that we need to think about? What is it going to be like, you know, I think we're all wondering what's going to be like a month from now or 3 months from now or 6 months from now. Forget about 5 years from now. I mean, that's sort of our time horizon right now. And there's a wonderful book called Competing for the Future. It was C.K. Prahlad and Gary Hamel. It was written in 1994. And they tell a story in the book about record stores. You know, so this is 1994. There still were record stores that you could go into. And they talk about the experience of going into a record store and why it's such a powerful experience. I mean, it really is the same thing as walking into an independent bookstore, in that you have that experience of knowledgeable staff, a wonderful selection, and you walk out the door with the item. But even Hamel and Prahlad in 1994 describe a different reality. And what they're saying is that, what they said was, there's going to be this place where you're going to be able to buy music electronically. It isn't going to be records. You're going to be able to buy it electronically. And there's going to be a device. And somehow you're going to be able to move the music to this device. And you're going to be able to buy tens of thousands of songs. I mean, it's going to be this nirvana. Now, we know what they're describing now, right? I mean, what they're describing is iTunes and the iPod and how, you know, in the last 5 years, you know, Apple has completely remade the music industry and how we use music, consume music, whatever the case might be. So here's two academics in 1994 that were basically describing what iTunes and the iPod were going to be 15 years later. So my argument to you is the record stores had to have known this was possible, right? But none of them took the action or were open to the idea of change, that there could be something different out there, that they could do something different. They were so invested in the business model that they had, in the customers that they had at the time, that they did not have the openness to change that they needed to be successful. And I guess I'd say, think about the businesses that you're in and how closely they match. I know for us in the publishing industry, I'm absolutely certain that we're next. You know, if the digital revolution is not going to happen to publishing, and I think it's going to happen in the next 12 months, I think we're finally, you know, how many people own Kindles? Anybody? Two. Right. How many people own Sony readers? Anybody? Okay, everybody skipped. What we're already seeing is those devices that are moving people away from paper and onto screens. I gave this talk a couple weeks ago, and everybody in the room was under 30, and I said, how many of you read the majority of your stuff on screens versus paper? And everybody raised their hand. You know, there's certainly a demographic shift. When you look at the publishing industry and in terms of all the inefficiency of moving books around and returns, and I could go on and on and on, but digital is going to happen in a really big way. And I know for us, if we think we're going to be in the business, 800 CREed, of being in the business of moving paper 5 years from now, we will probably not be in business. We need to redefine our business model. And I guess I would just encourage you to think about, in these times, how is your industry being disrupted by, you know, what's going on in the economy? These are the times when new business models come forward. These are the times when upstarts from places you never expect. Amazon was not a bookstore that decided to go start selling books. They came completely from left field. So just think about that from an openness to change standpoint. The last one I want to talk about, because I think it feeds back into all of the other ones, is feedback, and that we need mechanisms for feedback. What happens is that, I mean, from all of us as infants, I mean, from the moment we're born, we're constantly getting feedback, right? From our parents and from other people we're playing with. And it seems that once we get into organizations, we kind of just put everything off to the side, and we don't really build a lot of really great feedback mechanisms into what we do. I mean, how often is it that we're out really talking to customers? I mean, if you're a salesperson, you're doing it every day, and I absolutely understand that. But what if you're not? I mean, what if you're one of those organizational people sort of inside building the product? How often are you having that experience with the customer, finding out what it is that works for them and doesn't work for them in the products and services that you deliver? Or how often is it that if you're a manager, that you're really having that conversation with your reports, saying this is what's working and this is what isn't? I'm an engineer by training, and so one of the more subjective probably choices in the 100 Best is a book called To Engineer as Human. And it's written by a wonderful guy called Henry Petrosky. And what Henry talks about is the idea that failure is a wonderful thing to learn from. And again, this is one of those things that we intrinsically know. But again, in business, we don't tend to reward those people that fail. We tend to show them the door. And what we need to do is, failure is this wonderful thing to learn from. And whether it's, Henry tends to use big engineering examples. I'm thinking of the bridge, the I-35W bridge that collapsed 2 years ago in Minneapolis. As terrible as that was, and with the people that died, we learned a lot of stuff about building bridges as a result of that. It was a wonderful feedback mechanism for the engineering community. Petrosky tells a very detailed story, and some of you might remember this, of the Hyatt Regency bridge collapse in Kansas City, right, where a couple hundred people died. And he goes through all the way back through that process of all the things that were learned as a result of that. And even given the terrible consequences that were a result of that, all the things that we learned and how engineering got that much better. I interviewed him recently, and he said, you know, one of the amazing things about the Titanic is that the Titanic was a brand new vessel. It was using some of the most cutting edge engineering philosophies of its time. And it kind of ran into an iceberg. But had it not, many of those things that actually weren't the best things to put into practice would probably have been implemented across a much wider range of vessels. And it probably would have been much more dangerous over time. So my message to you is, if you're in a position to let people fail, let it happen, and even reward those people, and hold them up and within your organizations to say, here's someone who tried something, it didn't work, I'd like you to try something as well. Feedback is a wonderful thing, and if we can think about that more and more and more, I think all of us could be better improved. So the way I want to end is this. Every one of these five themes goes together, right? A clear purpose leads to better decision making, right? I mean, when we know what it is we should be doing, and and the people within our organization know what they should be doing, better decisions are made, and those decisions are made more quickly, right? Better decisions, what does that lead to? It leads to quicker action, because that's really what we want. What we want is action taking place in fast succession. We want to be moving forward. What does action lead to? Action leads to change, right? Something is going to be different. If I move these books, I took an action. Something is different after that happens, however small that is. And the fifth one is feedback. Feedback feeds back into all those other things. We can't possibly have better decision making or know if we're doing the right purpose or if the change that we're making is a positive one without the right feedback mechanisms. My call to action to all of you tonight is this. Think about one book you could read. I'm betting a lot of you probably have, as I do, either on my desk or my nightstand, a pile of books that you've been thinking about reading forever. Make a decision tonight to just read one of them, just one, you know, in the next 30 days. Really, it's 2 hours. Once you decide to do it, it's really just 2 hours. If reading a book doesn't work, an audiobook is great, right? Break it down into smaller segments. That's the amazing thing about that iPod we were just talking about. I can take it with me just about anywhere, whether it's at the gym or whatever else. So think about a book that you can read, because I think that business books have this wonderful way of helping us solve problems and think about things much more deeply. So thank you very much for having me tonight.
We've been listening to Todd Satterston, one of the co-authors of a recent book, The 100 Best Business Books, and now we move into our Q&A period, and I'd like to lead it off, if I may. I really appreciate the insights that you all bring in terms of, you know, this. We always attempt to try and distill things down to what's the essence of something and these themes. And I'm intrigued, and I'd appreciate you elaborating a little bit on this notion of inquiry. In the sense that among those five themes that you outlined, as you say, there's interconnectedness among them all, but there's also that notion of tension there, the bias for action, the decision making, the purpose. As you point out, sometimes it's good to not just clarify what the solutions are, but let's clarify the problem itself. Sometimes just clarifying the problem in better terms. All of which leads to sometimes, quote unquote, slowing down, which then runs into tension with bias for action. But the slowing down also allows us to listen, which is part of the feedback thing, and then get into the learning. So this whole notion of inquiry, appreciate if you'd maybe elaborate a little bit on that theme and your thoughts on it.
I guess I have two thoughts that come to mind. The first one I would say is that I think most world-class organizations build tension into how they work. You hear this constantly at Toyota. Toyota doesn't say, we're going to reduce inventory. What they say is, we're going to reduce inventory. We're going to do it in 30% of the space that it was before. And we're going to keep our parts supply where we can get a part anywhere in the world in 48 hours. They don't say we're going to do one of those things. They say we're going to do all three at the same time. When I was at GE, it's the same sort of thing. Sourcing had a whole set of metrics that sort of created a set of tension versus us in operations who were trying to put products out the door. I think there's a natural sense of tension in almost anything. The second one, and I might be diverting a little bit from what you said, but one of the things that we've been thinking about more and more as we've been talking about this is, if any of you are familiar with the work of Joseph Campbell, right, and the hero's journey, to us, these five things, they sound an awful lot like the hero's journey, right? Clear purpose, you know, find good decision making, take those actions, those sorts of things then lead to some sort of change, something's different as a result of that, and I learn something as a result. And so I don't know if I got close to your question or not, but I think it's a natural sense for, I think when you distill things down to those such basic, so fine things, you naturally sort of engage in tensions that have to be resolved one way or the other. I don't know if there's a simple answer to any of them.
Maybe just a little bit of tweaking on my question is, I think we're all confronted every day, and what I find fascinating about what we try and do here in this forum, business and leadership, it's not just all about suits and business stuff, because it's really about the business of leading our lives. And quite frankly, a lot of what I think we talk about has applicability in our personal as well as our professional lives. But this whole notion of, I think most of us learn early on that being an achiever, if you will, this bias for action. And so, again, my point was to try to query your feelings on, I'll call it inquiry versus advocacy. In other words, that sense of, boy, I got to jump right to it. I got to show that I know what I'm talking about, and I got to jump in and, you know, and solve that problem right away, when if I just maybe take a little time. In fact, there was a movie right recently, Gran Torino, where Clint Eastwood is the ultimate ready, fire, aim guy, and he's ready for action all the way around. And then toward the end of the movie, he says, well, we're just going to figure out here what's the best way to do it. And then he comes up with this solution. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie. Comes up with a solution that isn't exactly the ready, fire, aim. But he went into a mode of inquiry. And I was just, I've always had that impression in the business world where not only do we not appreciate failure per se, but we don't necessarily appreciate, you know, taking the time to really fully inquire about something. So that's where I was going. And if you have any further thoughts, otherwise we'll move on to.
Well, to your point, I think you can hear me. All right.
No, it's a microphone.
Well, fine. No problem. Sometimes the best decision is to do nothing. Often that's the best decision. So to me, it's too much of a platitude or slogan to say, and it kind of supports your point in a way. You and I have a little gray hair, so we have a little more experience. I've been in outside sales for 30 years, and many times the best thing to do is to do nothing and to let the river, the tributary, flow, almost a Zen-like or Eastern philosophical approach. Western philosophy, in my view anyway, places too much confidence in our ability to control things. Well, the fact of the matter is, we don't control much of anything at all. The best you can do often in situations is try to subtly influence things, and they'll take you, or other forces will take you to where you wish to get. So I don't find it really useful to say bias for action is such a great thing. I think often it leads to the wrong decision. I think what you were kind of inferring was taking the time to deliberate and the use of judgment that is borne out through experience, which may be no action.
And I don't think I disagree with that. I mean, Drucker said the same thing. I mean, Drucker had a lot off. Peter Drucker, you know, the management consultant, he's probably written 25 books. We review two of his books in the 100 Best. Drucker was pretty clear as well that, you know, it's okay to not make a decision. I don't think I want to, I'm not going to try to have it both ways here as I say this, but I think that if I start at the beginning, which is this idea that if I've got the right purpose, I think it informs the rest. I think that as we talk about sort of the idea of Zen, I mean, Zen, the idea is that I'm in this constant quest to find the person who I am, right? And what it is that, what in my life I'm meant to be. I think that when I solve that first problem, the other ones follow. And I think then you know when it's right to act, and you know when it's right to actually sway the river a little, as you say. Yeah.
Oh, hello. I bought a couple of your books. I hope you'll autograph them when we're done here.
Absolutely.
Listen, your presentation was absolutely marvelous, but I've got a few questions. How early in your life did you decide this was your career path? That's one question. Secondly, how many of your team are there now? You said something about 15 people or something like that. And then my third question is, I'd like to get an audience for you and be one of your clients. So how does one go about becoming one of your clients? I think everything you're doing is just beautiful. And I'm so happy to be here and tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thank you. How did I decide to get into this line of work? I would say that I've always been fascinated with business. I think business is this wonderful intersection of, it's almost like the application of the arts. I think psychology and anthropology and art, almost literally art as design, mathematics, engineering, I mean, all of these things come to play in business. I mean, I find that absolutely fascinating. I worked for GE. I was an engineer. I worked for GE for 6 years. Learned all sorts of wonderful, I mean, I couldn't have had a better training ground for business. I left to run a business with my father for 3 years. That's probably when I started reading the most business books, because we had a sales and marketing problem, and so I read everything I possibly could on sales and marketing in those 3 years. And I kind of continued this sort of quest for knowledge. And I met my co-author sort of on a random occurrence. We hit it off, and I've been doing this for the last 5 years. And every day I get to go to work, and it sounds like the craziest thing in the world. We're based out of Milwaukee. And Milwaukee. Yeah. And then there's 15 of us. So, yes.
I have a simple one. Yeah. Can you tell us what's in your book, 100 Best Business Books of All Time? What do you actually cover in there? Are they executive summaries? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, our purpose has always been to convince people to read books. And so when you read one of our reviews, what you'll find is it's this persuasive argument for the book. So what you might find is certainly we're going to talk about the main points in the book. We're going to share personal stories Jack and I had over the years in terms of how these books have impacted us. And so what we do in the book is there's 100 books. There's 12 different categories. We cover everything. We've kind of categorized them in a way that sort of matches what you'd expect. There's a chapter on strategy and leadership and sales and marketing and innovation and biographies and narratives and so on. In addition, every review is about 500 to 1,000 words. And at the end of every review, we have additional recommendations. So we certainly tell you about what we believe are the 100 best books, but we actually recommend another 295 books within the pages of the 100 best. And we recommend movies. And we recommend children's books, and we recommend a wide variety of places that you can go to, we think, learn about business. So there's all sorts of things. It's a carnival inside the book of all these wonderful things. So
my question is, what's the best book you ever read and why?
The best book I have ever read and why? I think the the best book that I've ever read is probably a book called Orbiting the Giant Hairball. And I'm not going to think of the guy's name right now. Gordon McKenzie. Gordon was an illustrator at Hallmark. And Gordon wrote this incredibly wonderful, beautiful book about creativity. And what the idea of Orbiting the Giant Hairball is that creative individuals need a way to, organizations need creative individuals, and creative individuals actually need organizations to be successful as well. And what he does is he talks about that tension, and he talks about orbiting the giant hairball as this idea that, you know, how is it that you can continue to exist in this world? And he tells these incredible stories. He's illustrated the whole thing himself. And I think it's a story that applies to any of us. There's lots of different chapters in the book, and I think chapter 19 is one page, and it says, Orville Wright didn't have a pilot's license. I love that. I absolutely love that. So it's about creativity and innovation. It's probably my best book, probably my favorite book.
So Todd, with email, we have instant communication, and we have tremendous breadth of issues. Mm-hmm. And so the first couple of questions had to do with instant communication, maybe slow down a little bit, maybe thought, maybe not even make a decision. My question has to do with the breadth of information. What might be good business practices to separate wheat from chaff, to separate issues from false issues, to separate what's important from what's not important?
So my first response, my immediate response to that is I want to say, I think it kind of goes back to the five things. I think we tend to concentrate on lots of all sorts of stuff. And I think that we don't concentrate enough on purpose and concentrate enough on decision making. And I still say we may not concentrate enough on action. I think that's where it starts. And I think that, I think that we're starting, if we haven't reached it, I think we're starting to come to a point where we have to make decisions about how we take in information and what are we going to turn on and what are we going to turn off. Because what I hear constantly being in the profession that I'm in is, I don't have time to read books. You know, this email thing. I mean, most of us are old enough to remember when there was an email. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that when there was an email. And I mean, what happened? I mean, what did we do with that, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day, it seems like, that we're doing managing email? I mean, what did we give in? We probably gave up some home time. We certainly gave up some other, you know, whether it was talking to people in the office or whatever it is. There's some really significant decisions that we need to make about the information we're going to take in. And I think my case for books is the fact that I think when we read books, we actually shut all the other stuff out. And it's almost an act of meditation. If we go back to the Zen thing, I think when you read books, it is almost an act of meditation, and that it's a flight simulator for your brain. You know, it's that I get lots of really cool ideas after I read books. I don't think I think there's something to that idea. And wheat from chaff, I think, ends up coming back to purpose. You know, how do I know what I should get and what I shouldn't? I think there's a constant struggle between, I think the web has started to deliver us exactly what we want, but there's like all this other stuff that we kind of need to still be exposed to. And if we tailor everything exactly to those things that fit our perfect profile, then we miss those random thoughts that I think encourage us to read other things. So one of the things in the 100 Best is we encourage people to read the narratives and the biographies, to read about other industries outside of our own. Read Michael Lewis's Moneyball, if you haven't. It's a wonderful story. It's a baseball story, and that's, you know, might be a problem for some people, but it's actually the story of a manager who completely redefined his industry and in the decisions that he made and so on. So I don't know if I did a good job, but I think it's almost an unanswerable question.
So we're listening to Todd Satterston, co-author of 100 Best Business Books, talk to us about helpful key themes. Sometimes I think we get ourselves into sucker's choices where we confront the question of either this or that, either action or inquiry and so forth, when in fact both and usually comes about to be usually where the answer is, and the difficult part is finding the sweet spot, right? We had David Allen here recently, the productivity guru, and I asked him his thoughts about effectiveness versus efficiency. So share your thoughts, if you will. Do we want to be effective? Do we want to be efficient? What do you think?
I think we want to be effective. I don't think it's a mistake that people, that it's the seven habits of highly effective people. I don't think it's a mistake that Peter Drucker's book was entitled The Effective Executive. I think there's something important in that word. Efficient just means I can move through things quickly. Effective, and I'm going to forget how Peter Drucker describes it, but he's very specific in his description in that it isn't just doing, but it's doing the right things. And I'm sure David had to have said something very similar. And I think that we're, again, back to that idea of, it's interesting that stockbrokers, for example, when all they do as their profession is decisions, right? It's either I'm going to buy or I'm going to sell. That's really all it is. The good ones spend a lot of time thinking about decision making. They spend a lot of time thinking about, not necessarily getting caught up in, oh, that was a bad trade, I should have never bought that in the first place, but they think a lot about how it is that I came to that conclusion in the first place. What was the process that I went through to decide that I was going to buy that stock in the first place? And I think we're all improved when we spend more time thinking about how we make our decisions. What are our biases? And now we're starting to get into the whole psychology side of things. I think it's that realm that we start to think an awful lot about effectiveness.
It is interesting, my recollection, I don't know if anybody else was here at the David Allen thing, but I was actually somewhat surprised at his answer, which in my ears, what I heard was he liked efficient more than effective. Just because of, I think, along the lines of, as you were saying, his bias toward this sort of Zen thing of emptying and all that. So I will give him what I think or what was that he said to be most effective, we got to be efficient type of thing, which really comes back to the both and. I'd like you to comment, if you would, on this the notion of not only your own business experience, but in all this readings and so forth. What do the writers and what do you see come through as themes of the major obstacles? That is, what gets in our way of doing these five things effectively and so forth? What seems to be, what are the biggest obstacles that we encounter, both in personal and professional lives, about our just human nature or whatever?
I think probably my favorite book on this is The Knowing Doing Gap by Bob Sutton and Jeff Pfeffer. They both teach down at Stanford. And they spend a lot of time talking about organizations, how organizations can't seem to get things done. And you're not going to be surprised probably by any of the answers. Fear, right? I mean, we're just afraid of whatever is going to happen next. And it can be personal fear, but it can also be organizational fear that I can't get beyond. But I mean, what's fear? Fear is the emotional reaction to risk, right? Risk is this, is just the calculation that we have about some change that's going to take place next. So fear is a huge one, and it's the emotional version of change, right? Institutional memory. We've always done it like this. I mean, that is a huge impediment, and it can be a protection, right? I mean, Good to Great is about the flywheel, right? I mean, anybody's read Good to Great? I mean, Jim Collins says the flywheel effect, that once I get the flywheel going, I keep going and going and going. It's a very powerful thing. But at the same time, it can also be this thing that stops us from action. It could be this thing that keeps us from where we want to go. The third one that they talk about is analysis, that we just get paralyzed by analysis, and then we spend more time debating what it is we should go do than actually going and doing.
You had indicated earlier a call for action, but as we kind of conclude our program here, I'd like to give you a couple minutes if you would like to summarize some other key thoughts that you'd like to leave us with. Please do that.
What else would I say? I think that, now you put me on the spot. I'm thinking here for a moment. I think that I think I would return back to where I started in that I think we're constantly dealing with problems, constantly. And it's ones that we can define clearly, like we know what this thing is, and we're just, we can't seem to get past it. Or it's the undefined, right? I feel it in my gut, and I think that we're constantly in a search for solutions. And I don't think I really care where you go try to find the solution. I think there's lots of wonderful places. The 100 best business books of all time might be a great place to start. The pile of books on your book stand. I think that I generally don't recommend the media because I think that they're so currency focused that we don't tend to get close enough to the insights that we need to be successful. It can help us in our decision making, but I think books get us a lot closer. And I know I keep saying books. I'm just suggesting them as a larger portion. It's like vegetables, right? We should all eat more vegetables. I think I'm just simply making the same case for our media diet should have just a smaller, just have a larger portions of books in it. And I think we would be all better served by it.
Well, I want to go back on myself to say that I just thought of one other thing that I'd like you to just address briefly.
Okay.
I saw the businessweek.com, and you and I were talking about it beforehand, mm-hmm. where they kind of dissed your book. They'd like to be the good critic. And one of the things that I noticed in what they said was that, yeah, but they don't do any books before 1980, mm-hmm. As if so. And you guys don't propose to be the best business books of all time. Mm-hmm. But I'd just like you to address a couple of these things that have come up that highlight a little more just about your project.
So we sat down with Hardy Green from Business Week about a week and a half ago. And Hardy immediately opened up his notebook and listed down the 12 problems that he had with our book. Now, Hardy is one of the few people in the industry who has the ability to do that. And so we were, actually, we thought it was a wonderful opportunity to sit down and actually talk really in depth about our book. And Hardy has a couple of problems. I mean, the first problem he has with our book is it's actually both sides. One side is the fact that it sort of is this realm from about 1980 till we actually do have a book from 2007. So he kind of said, well, what is it about 1980? I mean, why is it that, 94 of the books out of the 100 best were published after 1980? And what he said was, what it is, we actually believe business books changed in 1982 with In Search of Excellence. Anybody who was around far enough back then, In Search of Excellence was a watershed moment in business books. Before that, you read Drucker or you read some dense management journal, and that's about all business people had at that point. And what happened was Peters and Waterman delivered in this engaging narrative that was completely compelling, and suddenly the industry sort of followed and went, man, if we put more books out like this, maybe more people would buy them. And you have to understand, I think there was something also going on in industry as well, right? You had more power being pushed down further into the organization than ever before. It wasn't just CEOs and C-level managers who were making decisions. So there was a broader range of people that needed this sort of knowledge to be successful. I think it was also the first, entrepreneurship was always important, but entrepreneurship changed. I mean, Inc. magazine, I think, was founded in, it was either 80 or 81. I mean, there were some fairly huge trends that you had people leaving large organizations to start their own businesses. And so business books had to change. And, it was Iacocca the next year. Iacocca sold 1 million copies. I mean, it was sort of like the Harry Potter of 1983. I mean, it sold 1 million copies in like 2 months. I mean, for that era, it was huge. So that was his first problem. The other problem is he said we don't have enough recent books. We don't seem to be addressing the current economic crisis. And, my only qualm with that is Hardy knows how long it takes to do books. I mean, we had this book sort of, there's a couple of publishing people here tonight, and they're laughing. But, I mean, we had this book in the can like a year ago. And so for us to be adding, if you're looking for great books, for example, on what's going on with the economy, the couple I'd recommend would be Panic by Michael Lewis. He's put together basically an anthology of articles that start on Black Monday in like 80 whatever, and it runs all the way through till now. And it's a wonderful, I mean, it's just amazing to read us go through the first stock crash in the 80s, the currency crisis of kind of the 90s, the dot-com bust, which you're all intimately familiar with being in this part of the country, and then now the beginnings of what we're talking about here with the mortgage crisis and so on. So he didn't like that we have enough recency. His other problem, which I found extremely fascinating, was he said, we favor books that have too many takeaways. That was his problem. And he, too many takeaways. He thought that we were favoring the type of business book that would say, here are three things you should go do after you get done reading the book. I mean, it's the business book that we sometimes, how many business books have you read that either have a number in the title or some animal, right? I mean, that's kind of a little bit of the, you know, a little bit of the joke in business book publishing. But what Hardy tends to like is he tends to like narratives. He tends to like journalists telling these wonderful stories of companies and histories. And I got to be honest, we're kind of business people. I mean, there's three things that we did to choose our books. It had to be accessible. So all the books in the 100 Best were something you would actually sit down and read. Like, and it made sense when you were done with it. They used vocabulary that you understood. The second one was it applicable? Does it matter to somebody in business today? There's lots of books that get recommended. Again, it goes to that before 1980. I think there's lots of books that people like going back and reading. There are a couple of good ones. I still do recommend How to Win Friends and Influence People. I think Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. I think a couple of these books are still books worth going back and looking at. And the third thing that we said was, would we do the things that the authors recommend in their books in our own business? I mean, that was the litmus test for us. And if we said, if we would do it in our business, then it could be a book that we would recommend.
So. Well, I appreciate you sharing that with us. And let's put our hands together for Todd, please. We've been listening to Todd Satterston, one of the co-authors of the book, Best Business Books of All Time. Todd, we really want to thank you for sharing these tremendous insights. And as always, it brings forward the thing about common sense is not always common practice. So knitting some of these things together is really a terrific thing. And we just really appreciate you sharing those insights with us. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.